Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Magnificent Sex, Lessons from Extraordinary Lovers, by A. Dana Maynard, Ph.D., and Peggy J. Kleinplatz, Ph.D., narrated by Holly Adams. Part 1. Introduction. How did we come to be studying magnificent sex? I, P.J. K., have been teaching human sexuality at the University of Ottawa and practicing sex therapy for most of my life. One might think that sex therapists aim to improve patients' sex lives. To a certain extent, that is precisely what we do. We see clients who have symptoms of sexual dysfunctions, for example, erectile dysfunction, difficulties with orgasm, or pain on intercourse, and we help to alleviate their difficulties. Sex therapists are reasonably good at it. Unfortunately, though, that is about the extent of what we aim to do. We take people who have bad sex or painful sex and help them to function normally, whatever that means, so that they might have tolerable sex. We are rather limited in our goals. What are we to do about that most vexing of sexual problems, that is, low desire or frequency of sex? Low sexual desire / frequency is defined as engaging in sex less than 12 times per year. It is the most common of the problems encountered in sex therapy, and conventional treatment approaches have generally not proven to be effective in dealing with it. The state of the art in sex therapy stands in rather stark contrast to what our competitors in popular culture would have us believe about sex. The media are filled with images of great sex. Magazines and sex manuals are filled with tips, tricks, and techniques for how to have mind-blowing sex. A quick Google search will return millions of hits. Porn tends to make great sex look even easier. In fact, it looks utterly effortless. In the world of porn, all penises are hard, penetration requires no lube, a few thrusts are all a woman needs to be orgasmic, there are never interruptions unless someone arrives for a threesome, and there is an absence of verbal communication, unless one counts moans and groans. Porn provides convincing and entertaining fiction, so captivating that it is easy to forget it is about as realistic as children's fairy tales, and just like fairy tales, it leaves us with the message that dreams can come true. I have no problem with porn, except insofar as my patients and students mistake it for reality and judge themselves as unable to measure up. Which way to erotic intimacy? The link between the vestiges of erotic potential harbored by clients and the anticipation engendered by desirable sex became apparent in my sex therapy practice in the 1980s. In late 1989, three clients were referred to me in the course of 1 week, each diagnosed with what was then called inhibited sexual desire, or simply low desire, subsequent to a history of childhood sexual abuse. I had learned by then to ask clients routinely about their best sexual experiences rather than focusing only on their current problems. This turns out to be a particularly advantageous inquiry in dealing with low sexual desire. I asked these three clients to describe the incidents in their pasts when they had been filled with intense sexual longings. For people who have no recollection of ever having wanted sex, such a question may at first seem puzzling. Yet, all three of these individuals were able to identify memories of powerful erotic desires, of wanting more, though more of what was not clear. Each had been an adolescent, making out while fully dressed. Each conceded there had been no genital contact, let alone sex. If these individuals had felt their peak sexual desire had occurred while they were still virgins, it made me wonder what it means when we speak of sexual desire. In fact, it made me wonder what we mean by sex. Why do people settle for lackluster sex lives when they have had a glimpse of their dreams? What would the best sex look like if people actually had the opportunity to experience it? These musings changed my clinical career, and led me to focus on helping my clients to develop optimal erotic intimacy regardless of past experiences. More importantly, they led me to wonder about why so many people think they ought to feel sexual desire in the absence of sex worth wanting. It was another series of events that changed the trajectory of my research career. In 2004, I was teaching human sexuality, and one of the undergraduate students kept asking questions that came out of reading Glamour and Cosmo. She would compare and contrast messages put forth by women's magazines with the studies she had heard about in my classes. She wanted data about great sex. That was how I came to meet A. Dana Maynard, then an undergraduate student, later to become A. Dana Maynard, Ph.D. She had a strong background in hard sciences and had already earned 2 scholarships to support her burgeoning career in bee research. It was perhaps her misfortune that 1 too many bee stings had led to an allergic reaction, and my good fortune to begin working with her in studying optimal sexual experience. In 2005, we began to study great sex. But where might we gather knowledge on the kinds of sex worth wanting? It was in 2005 that we and the Optimal Sexual Experiences research team of the University of Ottawa began our series of studies on extraordinary lovers and how their experiences might inform average people and ordinary sex therapists who might want to aim higher. It is these studies and their implications for couples, for therapists, and for sex itself that we plan to share in this book. In parallel to the optimal sexual experience studies, Dr. Maynard, then a graduate student, began a program of research examining the portrayal of sex, sexuality, and romance in the media, ranging from advice columns to romance novels to slasher movies. She was quickly amassing the data that demonstrated how badly the public was being misinformed about sex. What is the plan for this book, and for whom is it intended? This book begins with an overview of our studies and will provide some background as to why we undertook them, Chapter 1. Although the fields of sex research in general, and sex therapy in particular, have amassed a great deal of information on bad or dysfunctional sex and average or functional sex, the literature on great sex or magnificent sex is close to non-existent. Our empirical work, we hope, will begin to change that. We then describe precisely how we undertook the research, recruited participants, and which questions we asked to help us find meaningful and clinically useful answers. In short, in order to study optimal sexual experience, we needed data as to what great sex really is and how it resembled or differed from media depictions. The components or building blocks of magnificent sex are described in Chapter 2. Once we had empirical findings as to what constituted real-life optimal erotic experience, we wanted to know what lessons extraordinary lovers might have to offer the rest of us, Chapter 3. In Chapter 3, we will contrast the reality of extraordinary erotic intimacy with media-driven, misleading ideas about great sex. That is, we will expose and debunk the myths and expectations that so hamper attempts to improve sexual relations. We then wanted to know what factors facilitate and help to bring about magnificent sex, chapters 4 through 12. We defined contributing factors as widely as possible. We were interested in anything that might lead to magnificent sex across time, the qualities of the individuals and their relationships, or some combinations. We inquired about everything from the distant past of the individual to recent personal and relational developments as adult lovers become increasingly intimate, Chapter 4, to whatever partners might do immediately beforehand in preparation for making sex extraordinary. Chapter 5. No, it's not about having the bed strewn with rose petals. We studied the enduring qualities and skills of the individual, Chapter 6, and the relationship, Chapter 9, as compared to the contributors right then and there during sexual activities, which helped to make a particular encounter unforgettably erotic and fulfilling, chapters 7 and 10. That is, whereas most sexual dysfunction / therapy research is concerned with the general factors that lead to sexual difficulties, we were interested in what makes sex magnificent. As such, chapter by chapter, we will review the elements in the person, in the relationship, both in general and specifically, while engaged in sex, which contribute to optimizing erotic experience. We also sought to identify the skills required to make sex extraordinary. Chapter 8. In the course of our research, the roles of heightened empathy and superb communication stood out on multiple levels, as crucial building blocks of optimal sexual experiences, as facilitating factors that helped create anticipation and lead to magnificent sex, as an element that made the experience magnificent during sex. Therefore, we devote an entire chapter to empathic communication, chapter 11. Surprisingly, although the view from the peaks of optimal sexual experiences is remarkably similar, whether from the vantage point of an older monogamous heterosexual couple after 50 years of marriage, or a 22-year-old bisexual polyamorous BDSM aficionado, the paths towards the heights are quite distinctive. We will examine and consider the combinations of contributing factors which create multiple pathways towards more fulfilling sexual relations in Chapter 12. We continue by discussing the implications and applications of our findings for lovers who want more out of their sex lives, as well as sex and couples therapists who might wish to help clients experience greater heights of erotic intimacy. Chapter 13. That is also where we will circle back to where we began. How can research on extraordinary lovers be of value to couples distressed over low to no sexual frequency / desire, and of course to their therapists? Please note that at every step, we will be emphasizing the plurality of ways of being sexual and of discovering routes to magnificent sex. It is no secret that the media portray great sex as the purview of the young, beautiful, and able-bodied in romantic, monogamous, heterosexual relationships. We beg to differ. We have found optimal sexual experiences occur among the young and old, among the healthy as well as disabled or chronically ill, and among people with every sexual orientation and proclivity, in monogamous and consensually non-monogamous relationships. More importantly, this book will be descriptive rather than prescriptive. We will be describing what we have discovered and how our findings could be useful for those who are so inclined. We are not suggesting what anyone ought to do, let alone trying to raise the bar for people's sex lives. For one thing, we promised one of the participants, an older gentleman, that we would honor his wishes, and besides, we agree with him strongly. But in terms of how you go about doing it, I wouldn't believe a cookbook. If you guys come up with a cookbook and you tell me to follow it, you would have to really convince me that there's a cookbook approach where I can do this. PK. Relax. We're not planning a cookbook. Thank heavens. My wife loves cooking. She follows lots of recipes exactly. Often she doesn't. But it turns out great lots of times. Some things can be done without fail. This isn't one of those. This book is intended for anyone who is interested in learning about truly extraordinary erotic intimacy and how it might be attained. There are too many people diagnosed with sexual desire disorders whose sex lives leave them feeling empty at best or alone and alienated, wondering what all the fuss is about. We are inclined to suggest that their low desire may be evidence of good judgment. We would not expect normal people to have strong desires for low-quality sex. This book is for them. Their partners, who try and too often feel painfully frustrated and rejected, might want to consider the possibility that higher levels of mutual erotic intimacy can be part of the solution to their problems. Or to put it another way, many patients diagnosed with low desire problems will comment, "If I never had sex again, I wouldn't miss it." We have yet to hear an individual who has had magnificent sex express such a sentiment. Lots of individuals and couples in new relationships, or who have been together for a while, have a sense that although their sex lives are satisfactory, there might be something more out there. We are here to tell them that their intuitions are correct, to describe what magnificent sex looks like, and for those who wish to put in the time and energy, because it won't just happen spontaneously, what some extraordinary lovers have done to improve their sex lives substantially. The reader might be a person at midlife or older who is wondering if his or her sexual future is destined to be dismal or non-existent. The reader might be a virgin who is wondering what kinds of sex could be worth the wait. This book is for those people too. We are also reaching out to our colleagues in the fields of couples and sex therapy and education. The study of magnificent sex has important educational and clinical applications. Just as too much of what passes for sex education is really reproductive biology, too much sex therapy is oriented towards helping clients eliminate sexual dysfunctions so that normal sexual functioning can be attained. It is illuminating that after conventional sex therapy alleviates obstacles to sexual intercourse, for example, erectile dysfunction, patients still seem to maintain their low frequencies of sexual activity. Or they now report new problems, including difficulties with orgasm and low sexual desire. For the sex therapists, this can be conceptualized as symptom substitution, comparable to when a patient triumphantly quits smoking, only to begin eating excessively and gaining 30 pounds. More to the point, sometimes the physical symptoms of sexual dysfunctions originate in the body's understandable response to sex that is, or was, mechanically functional but otherwise uninspiring. Our bodies silently plead for sex that makes us feel alive and engaged in one another's embrace. When that is not in reach, our spirits begin to decline, as does the desire for the type of sex that is available. We are aiming to broaden the field of sexology by adding to our knowledge of the entire spectrum of sexualities, from dysfunctional to normal to optimal. We are especially hoping that a clear-eyed, empirically based look at the farther reaches of human erotic potential can help to inform and expand our methods and goals in working in couples and sex therapy in general, and with the most vexing of sexual problems in particular, sexual desire discrepancy. Perhaps a focus on the quality rather than the quantity of sex as perceived by each of the extraordinary lovers can assist clients to find the kinds of erotic intimacy that each could anticipate and savor with delight. 1. How did we set out to learn about magnificent sex? From the dismal to the ordinary to optimal sexual experience. Readers who want to get straight to the good stuff, that is, the ingredients or components of magnificent sex, please feel free to skip ahead to Chapter 2. In the Western world, great sex is the subject of great contradiction in the public sphere. On the one hand, the pursuit of amazing sex is represented in media sources as one of the primary goals of humankind. It is assumed to be virtually universal based on the covers of women's and men's magazines, the topics discussed on television talk shows, the titles of thousands of self-help books, the proliferation of advice on the internet, and depictions in pornography. It seems clear that great sex is considered very desirable and that many people want to have it, or more of it, but do not know how to go about this. Media advice is often characterized by a focus on performance, with suggestions for how to achieve great sex revolving around the use of specific stimulation techniques, new positions, and the addition of novelty, for example, using props. Most of the time, media definitions of sexuality, whether optimal or not, tend to be riddled with gender stereotypes and sexual myths. The belief in these myths may actually engender sexual problems rather than fixing them. Despite the evident interest from the general public, the vast majority of the literature on sexual functioning is focused on sexual dysfunction, with thousands of studies on erectile dysfunction, premature ejaculation, low desire, sexual arousal disorder, and other kinds of difficulties and problems. Normal sexual functioning, which has received much less research attention, is often equated with normal physiological functioning. However, many individuals who have impaired physiological functioning, that is, who are unable to engage in intercourse or orgasm, are not distressed by this, whereas many others who have normal physiological functioning are nevertheless dissatisfied with the quality of their sexual experiences. The inevitable conclusion from the focus on sexual dysfunction is that optimal sexual experiences are by default equated with the absence of sexual dysfunctions. The lack of attention in the literature to wonderful sexual experiences reflects the overall trend in psychology to focus on the negative aspects of human experience. In general, research or theory about how to bring about wonderful, incredible, optimal, or peak experiences of any kind, that is, sexual or non-sexual, is lacking, with notable exceptions. Humanistic psychologist Abraham Maslow used the term peak experience to describe those moments of highest happiness and fulfillment. He characterized these peak experiences as mystic and ecstatic, involving a sense of great awe, intense happiness, or bliss. Mayer studied optimal behaviors, which included welcoming the moment, being attuned, receptive and responsive to bodily felt sensations, being open and welcoming to different parts of the self, and appreciating the personal world of others. Similarly, some sex therapists have suggested that wonderful sex includes such elements as communication, a focus on pleasure rather than performance, a non-genital focus, openness, variety, intimacy, relaxation, anticipation, affection, orgasm, and ecstasy. This clinical work provides an alternative to media definitions of great sex. Because the academic study of sexuality has focused primarily on dysfunctional or normal sexuality, the topic of optimal sexual experiences has been marginalized and neglected. The result is that our understanding of sexual experiences is incomplete at best. That left us plenty of room to begin studying magnificent sex. What questions were we trying to answer? The first thing we needed to learn was what makes some sex magnificent. That has two meanings. How would one describe the elements that comprise optimal sexual experience? That is, what is it about these experiences that is unique or distinctive? How are they different from everyday sex or from good or even very good sex? How would you recognize great sex if you stumbled into it? The second meaning of our opening question is, what leads to or can account for the occurrence of extraordinary sex? What factors facilitate the experience of extraordinary erotic intimacy? These were our opening queries. We needed to answer the first set of questions before we could later identify how to bring about magnificent sex. Our goal for the first study in this project was to identify and understand the components that constitute optimal sexual experience. This was a crucial stage for several reasons. When we embarked on this research, there were no empirical definitions of great sex or optimal sexual experiences or wonderful sex or fantastic sex or any conceptually related ideas available in the academic or sex therapy research literature. We needed to define our terms to ensure that it was clear what was meant by magnificent sex, and that participants' responses were comparable, that is, that they were talking about the same kind of experience. This research was conducted within the framework of descriptive phenomenology, an approach to gathering data that is used within discovery-oriented, qualitative methodologies to produce descriptions of previously unexplored phenomena. Phenomenological researchers aim to grasp the richness of a phenomenon from different participants' subjective realities/experiences. But which participants would be required? In phenomenological research models, one seeks out individuals who have particular knowledge and experiences in the area under investigation, known as key informants. It seemed that the most obvious and accurate way to answer our questions was to consult with individuals and couples who had developed expertise in this area, that is, people who had experienced magnificent sex. Who did we decide to talk to and why? My PJK clinical experience had given me a glimpse as to who might be the sought-after experts. Most of us are raised to think of sex through a fairly narrow lens. The circumscribed definition of sex often becomes one of the obstacles to enjoying sex fully. I had noticed that among my clients, many of those who had found unique avenues for the fullness of sexual expression had been those who had gone beyond the parameters of conventional definitions of sex. Some of these seemed on the outside to be quite ordinary individuals. They worked hard, raised children, and had been married for many years. Why were they in my office? Sometimes they came to sex therapy because life had handed them a new challenge. One of them had developed cancer or heart disease or diabetes. A family member had died. There had been a job loss or a retirement. A new medication had affected sexual functioning. An astute primary care physician had noticed that a change in their lives after many years of marriage was beginning to disrupt their sexual relationship and had referred them to me. It struck me as ironic and meaningful that precisely the matters that had challenged them now created new opportunities for growth and development. It was like the old curse, "May you live in interesting times." These couples were typically older and were ready to face whatever lay ahead by deepening their levels of intimacy. Here, when I refer to intimacy, this is not a euphemism for sex. Rather, the quality of their sexuality and emotional intimacy seemed to provide the foundations for erotic development in the face of tough times. How illuminating that these seemingly ordinary older couples, the ones we typically think of as the marketing targets for KY Jelly and Viagra, revealed how extraordinary they could become as lovers once life forced them to redefine sexual intimacy. Similarly, some of the others who had, of necessity, learned to think outside the box in order to redefine themselves as sexual beings were members of sexual/gender minority groups. These might be individuals who were lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer or questioning, LGBTQ, or who might identify as into BDSM, that is, bondage and discipline, or dominance and submission, or sexual sadomasochism, or some combination, or kink. They might be individuals in consensually non-monogamous relationships. In therapy, I had noticed that anyone who had had to re-envision sexuality en route to full sexual expression stood a pretty good chance of ultimately having an out-of-this-world sex life. These were my clinical impressions. It was now time for a broader, empirical study of magnificent sex. These insights, however, proved a useful starting place for our team to think about who to recruit for our research. Who, we wondered, would have this experience or expertise? For the reasons enumerated here, participants recruited for this study consisted of 1. Individuals over the age of 60 who had been in a relationship for 25 years or more, 2. Self-identified members of sexual minority groups, and 3. Sex therapists. The sexuality of older people has often been marginalized in mainstream media representations, in magazines, romance novels, television shows, and movies. Great sexual experiences are usually reserved for young, attractive, able-bodied individuals.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?